Hello and welcome to the Buzzcast. I'm Andrew James.
And I'm John Adams.
And here in our ninth episode, we'll be answering some questions on shooting video with your stills camera and serving up an insightful tip on what you can do in the woods that's still legal right now to get some cracking fungi shots. But before we get onto all of that, John, you've got something for us, haven't you?
One thing I've been thinking about, Andrew, is years and years ago, I did some stuff for a film company that did lots of tank work for wildlife programs. And one of the things we'd regularly do if we needed close-ups was we would refrigerate flies and insects to kind of calm them down, take them into that kind of pre-dawn state, which would make them quite placid and quite still when you came to getting your focus and getting your macro shots and this kind of thing. I felt sort of okay about it because it was just accepted practice, but I don't think I'd do it now because I don't feel it's right for... I mean, they weren't suffering, but I don't think it's right to create that kind of artificial sense of potential suffering just for taking a photograph. But then as soon as I say that, I think, well, there's no harm being caused, so is it okay or isn't it? Where are you on the kind of the ethics on... Perhaps it may broaden into more ethics in photography, but certainly on insect life... How do you feel about that?
I think you're right that it was an accepted practice, and I can remember back in the days on film days writing that as a tip to do with a macro feature or whatever. It was an accepted thing that you did. But then when you think about it, if you look at the world in general, there's a lot of accepted practices on all sorts of things in the past, which when we look at it now are completely unacceptable. You can think about those yourself. We don't have to mention them now. So I actually personally never done it. I've never chilled a butterfly, at least I can't remember ever having tried to do it, a butterfly or insect down in the fridge for photography. I personally, I'm not a kind of one of these people who thinks you can't do anything and you know, you're a total tree hugger, vegan, whatever. So I accept that, you know, there are things that happen in this world where, you know, in the world of nature, shall we say, that isn't always great. Doesn't mean I like it, but I know these things happen. In terms of insects and photography, I personally think that it's not right to take them out of their natural environment and pop them in the fridge and cool them down and then photograph them. I know that you're probably not doing any great harm to them in the terms of the cooling them down because you're just mimicking what happens naturally, overnight. But in the act of catching them, potentially you're harming them. You've got to handle them.
Things like butterflies with their wings, very, very delicate wings, or moths.
So however gentle you are, however careful you are, there is that potential to harm that creature. So for my mind, John, it would be better to go, if you get up earlier or to stay out a bit later, you know, try and find these creatures when they're not so active and flappering. Is that a butterfly? Fluttering, that was the word I was looking for. Fluttering about with, you know, a lot of heat on their wings and they're really active and they're quite hard to photograph. For that first hour after sunrise or first couple of hours after sunrise, they will be a lot more chilled out, for want of a better term right now, and you're able to get good pictures of them. I don't know, that's how I feel about it anyway.
So your view is the photographer should make the effort by getting up at pre-dawn or whatever to go and get to those environments where they can shoot it naturally rather than trying to recreate what happens naturally by chilling them.
Yeah, as a general rule, I mean, I know the thing is, if that's possible, because then you think, well, okay, what about moths? Because, you know, pretty much most photographs of moths involve catching them in a moth trap.
Yeah.
What about, you're saying about tank work, but, you know, underwater insects. I mean, I know I have done this or been involved in doing this, and that's putting basically damsel nymphs into a tank, waiting for them to hatch out, and then photographing the free swimming nymph version of the damsel fly underwater for magazines.
Yeah.
You know, and All right, we then release those back into a lake or into a river afterwards, probably to be eaten by a fish or something. So actually, should we have kept... I think that there's a problem here is that maybe we can actually get too ethical amount of stuff. Because if you want to take this to the extreme, I'm saying, no, don't chill these insects down, go into their natural world. But what happens if I accidentally trod on one, or I accidentally break a bit of the foliage that they like to go, where do we draw the line with this?
Well, I suppose the extreme is the Jainist philosophy, isn't it, in India, which is the kind of fairly extreme philosophy that causes no harm and goes out of its way to cause no harm to any living creature. So they will drink through a sort of kind of a cheesecloth, Jainists, in order to stop, ingesting any microbes or whatever that they may harm in the process of swallowing them, which seems rather extreme.
Yeah.
But you've reminded me of a time where some tank work I did was tickling a pistol shrimp with a small paintbrush in order to get its claw. Pistol shrimps stun their prey by punching the water. And,
right, okay.
And the shock waves knock out the prey, and that's how it does what it does.
You weren't just trying to make it laugh.
I wasn't trying to make it laugh. No. They don't laugh much, pistol shrimps. But that was what I did, and I didn't really think anything of it, because this was filmed, this went out on TV, and it was obviously something that fascinated the audience viewing it in a nature program. So there's a general benefit of seeing how nature works, the wonders of nature. But of course, yes, it didn't involve any suffering, I don't think, unless of course it was ticklish.
Well, yeah, but unless you were the one that was hit by the pistol shrimp's bullet.
Yeah, well, that's another thing. Praying mantis shots, the flies that they use to feed them, or the maggots for your fish, whichever way you look at it, the flies don't come out of that well.
No.
The mantis is quite happy and will pose there for quite a while under the studio lights, but the flies that it's eating don't look too good.
That hence my point about, we have to be careful to be sit on some sort of ethical pedestal, because we're actually, to some degree, once you do anything that involves walking in nature, you potentially leave a footprint that might cause a problem. Do you know what I mean? But to take us back to the original question, I don't think, and I think this is the bigger thing for me anyway, is that there's no need to chill a butterfly down in a fridge when you can get up at a time when it's easy to, not easy, it takes a bit of work and a bit of effort, but you can go and capture a photograph of a butterfly in a natural environment at a time when it's naturally cooled down and naturally less active.
Yes, I think I agree. As a photographer going into an environment, you should be the one bending to the environment rather than trying to do it the other way around. So, yeah, I agree with that. But I'd be really interested to hear what buzzers have to say about that. I know we've got some philosophers within the audience there. So what their view is on nature ethics and photo ethics, I'd be fascinated to hear what that is.
Yeah, so photo buzzer Kant, photo buzzer Wittgenstein, photo buzzer Plato.
And, of course, photo buzzer Russell.
Yes. Oh, yes, one of my favourites. Absolutely. Yeah. All those.
Photo buzzer Hume. I want to hear from him.
Love Hume. He's a great... Some of his work in the portraiture area as well is particularly impressive. Anyway, all you philosophizing photo buzzers, please leave a comment and give us your views, because that's what this is all about, stimulating some debate.
Well, it's now time for Q&A or questions and answers, if you like to have things in full form. Andrew, I'm going to upgrade my DSLR with a view to shooting stills and some video. How important is 4K for video capture?
That's actually quite a nice question. And I think that 4K really is the buzzword, isn't it? It's the current thing that you are led to believe by all the marketing that you absolutely have to have, whether you're shooting video or actually whether you're even watching it on your TV. It's all the trend to have a 4K TV to see it in ultra high D kind of situation.
That's it.
But the reality might be a little bit different.
Well, yes. I mean, most people are using HD or high definition. I mean, that's a particular ratio that we're familiar with. You know, it's what the BBC broadcast it in their HD channels, as do ITV and Channel 4 and 5. And we've got Sky generally puts stuff out at high definition. So that's where we are with broadcast television. We know what HD is. But ultra-high definition, or 4K, is something that essentially is four times the quality of high definition. So if you imagine your HD TV, and then you put another one to the right of it, then another one below it, then another one below it, you've got four times the area of pixel coverage. So you've got a really massive file. And the question is, you know, do you actually need that?
Okay, well, I'm going to stick my neck out here and say no. No, you don't. And I'm not saying that if you have the opportunity to use it because your camera is 4K enabled, then have a play with it, because there are some advantages that maybe we could go into. But ultimately, there are some big disadvantages with it too. So, for example, that file size, as you say, it's such a massive kind of amount of information in there, massive amount of data. You have this huge file size that you've got to manage in your card at the shooting time, plus you've got to manage in terms of storage, plus you need the processing power just to edit the damn thing.
Yeah, I mean, that's the big issue with 4K. The advantages of it is you've got this huge high-quality file, and that means if you're going to have an HD output, you can crop into 4K. So if you think in video terms, you might want to have, let's say you're doing a blog, something like that, and you want to shoot yourself in a sort of a mid-shot, something like you're kind of a half-shot from waist up. You've got you describing what you're going to do with your camera. With 4K, what you can then do is use that same footage and crop in on your face, because there would be enough resolution there in the initial file to be able to do that. If you did that with an HD file, you wouldn't have enough resolution for it to be a really clear, crisp picture on the crop. But that's mainly how 4K is used in the editing scenario, to actually give you more variety. You can zoom into areas, you can pan across a scene, you can do all these kind of things. You can do in-camera movements.
You can be clever. You can be clever.
Yeah, you've got lots more creative freedom. But the cost, as you rightly point out, is you've got a massive data packet to organise.
And actually, the thing you mentioned there about cropping, and what you were talking about the editing side, obviously, in terms of shooting, and a lot of people might not actually realise it, if you've got a DSLR that's 4K enabled, so you can shoot a 4K footage, a lot of the time, maybe all of the time, I don't know, that's cropped, isn't it, in terms of focal length, once you actually shoot at 4K?
Yeah, I mean, some of the buzzers may correct me, but I can't think of any particular stills camera, a CSC or DSLR, that actually shoots full frame 4K. I think they all have to crop the sensor in order to get that data. So that means, effectively, your wide-angle lenses aren't as wide anymore. They'll be 1.5 times longer, or sometimes 2 times longer, or some are even like 2.3 times longer. So you lose your wide-angle lenses by shooting in 4K, which means you've got to move back quite a bit. But as we all know, you can't always do that.
Yeah, I guess it's not a deal breaker in terms of using it, but it's another consideration that you need to think about.
Yes, you may well lose your wide angle settings, your wide angle lenses. And you know, that's a great advantage if you're shooting some wildlife clips, because you get that extra on the long end of the lens.
Yes.
But of course you lose it on the short end. So that's one thing to bear in mind and consider. The only sort of true 4K cameras tend to be the sort of cinema style cameras. Things like Canon C100, 200, 300, the XC15, these kind of cameras, which actually are native 4K cameras. They will still output in high definition if you want that, so you can save some data or some file size by using HD. But they're the only ones that actually are native 4K cameras, and what you see is what you get when it comes to 4K capture.
Yeah, definitely. And I think it's actually quite fascinating that we're talking about shooting video with your DSLR or with your camera. This has been enabled since digital came in with live view, et cetera, but, you know, it's completely changed the face of filmmaking in a way. And I know I said this, and, you know, when that option became a potential or a possibility with my camera, I thought, well, why do I want to shoot video? Now I shoot commercial video, you know, as part of my job. You know, it has changed the way that we or the way that we work and the way that we're able to work. And I appreciate that many buzzers may be, well, I've never even touched the video side of it. And you may not want to create a next movie or anything grand, but actually it's a lovely option to have if you know how to use it.
This sort of dovetails into another question we've got, which is, I want to make some videos for blogging and websites. Are DSLRs the best option? Yeah. So perhaps we can kill two birds with one stone and kind of address both those issues, the 4K thing and the most suitable camera for video capture at the same time. So, I mean, is a DSLR the best camera to have for video?
Maybe just to finish off the last thing, I'm going to stick with that 4K isn't essential. Do you disagree with me there?
I think high definition is essential,
yes,
but 4K isn't an essential thing. That shouldn't be the deal maker or breaker if you want to capture video with your camera, because HD, you'll get full resolution, you'll get great quality, and certainly for blogs or for websites, I mean, people are watching these things on their phone. Why do you need a 4,000 pixel wide image to do it?
Yeah, no, that's very true. So, okay, so that's where we're going with that question. Put that to bed, bang, done. In terms of the next question that came up, is a DSLR best for video? No, not necessarily. I mean, it's very much. I mean, we're shooting commercial video quite a lot now. We might be using DSLRs, which we do a lot, and there's a reason for that. We might be using camcorder. We might be using GoPro. We might be using our phone. All these are options. It's about the right piece of kit for the job that you're doing, not about anything else.
That's it. I mean, one thing that you have to remember about the filmmaking side of things, you're telling stories, and the most engaging part of a film isn't the equipment used, it's the story you're telling. So whether you squirt something off on a phone or use a little GoPro or whatever it may be, it's just part of that storytelling process. So image quality is actually secondary in 99% of filmmaking. It's the story you're telling and how that's assembled and how that communicates and works with your audience. That's the important bit, not the quality of the device you've used to capture it. They're just tools for the job, and some may be more appropriate than others.
And I guess to kind of get to the detail of this particular question, if you're just doing some videos for blogging, and to me that would be, I'm guessing that's somebody talking to the camera about what they're doing. Say you're in a hide or something and you want to talk about your setup and what have you. In those circumstances, I would just use my phone. I mean, I've got an iPhone. Other phones are also available. But the quality you can get with something like that, important you have it static, so it's set up on a tripod. You can do what you want with that. One of the keys, and I know this is a big thing for you, John, is that the sound is so important, isn't it? It's the quality of the sound as much as the quality of the image here.
Sound, particularly for things like blogs. Whenever anyone's speaking, you know, if you're doing a pop video, then sound comes from elsewhere. It doesn't matter what you record there and then. But if you're blogging, or you have to have good quality sound, because sound is 50% of video. That's the way to think about it. So if you're speaking, if you want to communicate to people, good sound is essential. And if you use the camera mic, whether it's in a DSLR or on a phone or any other device, if you use the microphone next to the lens that's built into the camera, 90% of the time that will not be good enough, because you'll get too much background noise and all the rest of it. So what you need...
Why is that then? Why is it not very good? Well, I mean, what could go wrong with doing it like that?
Let's just do a quick live example if we can. Let's say I'm speaking like this on our Buzzcast. Now, this is the kind of sound we've got, reflections, we've got a bit of reverb from the room we're in, from our recording studio, because I'm not near the microphone. I'm facing the wrong way. So this will be low quality sound. Whereas, of course, if I put on voiceover man's voice and I talk, with a bit of intimacy near the microphone, because I am close to the microphone, everything is much clearer. The emotion in my voice is so much clearer.
Oh, darling, it's a wonderful performance.
But you see what I mean? The sound is everything, because now we've got, when someone's listening to this, they can hopefully hear what I'm saying very clearly and get a real feel for what's going on.
Whereas if we do it like that, everything sounds a bit rubbish. And this sound you can hear now is the kind of thing you're going to get from any device, however good your DSLR is, even if you're using... a really fantastic cinema camera with a built-in microphone. This is the kind of rubbish audio you're going to get.
Whereas what you need is something like that. Yeah. Was that a good live demo?
Better than me putting my
hand over my mouth and talking like that.
You're doing the old Brit Rail announcement there, aren't you?
I was. So look, what we're saying here is that if you want to shoot stills and video with your DSLR, what that will give you is a great creative tool. And because you'll have a range of lenses as normal for your stills, that will also give you lots of options with your filming too. If you've got 2.8 lenses, you can create a nice cinema look. You can do all that. But it might be just more than you actually need for doing something like a simple vlog or blog, whatever you want to call it.
If you're blogging, you want stuff to be quick and easy to set up.
I think it's vlogging.
Vlogging, yes.
Isn't that what they say now?
Vlogging, video logging, yes.
Yes, something like that, I don't know.
Vlog is weblog, isn't it?
Is
so
it?
A vlog is a video weblog. Yeah, whatever.
Yeah.
The essence for that kind of stuff, quick and easy, is you know, good quality is kind of expected now on YouTube and various other things, but you've got to get that quality in an easy way that's quick to set up.
Just to wrap up, I mean, for example, if you're going to use your phone for vlogging, then you can get yourself a little wired microphone that plugs into your phone and you can clip to your jacket. I've used it a lot for some of the PhotoBuzz videos that I've done in the past that will give you excellent quality sound. And it won't cost you more than about £20.
You know, you can use professional microphones for this kind of thing, but it's really not necessary. As long as you can put up with a wired mic, and you normally can, because you're not going to be far away from your phone, particularly if you're you know, using the front-facing camera and pointing it back at you, you're going to be quite close to it. So you can just plug in a wired mic. I think they're like $14.99 or something off Amazon or eBay. And they're great little microphones. They're not quite as good as your £500 or £1,000 Sony or Sennheiser radio mic, but they work just as effectively. And yes, we've used those for stuff that's kind of broadcast quality, so you can do it with these little wired mics. They're very, very good.
No, they are. And I mean, if you want to, you can still do a walk and talk if you want. You know, you can put your phone on a gimbal, like the Osmo. Other gimbals are available. And as long as, you know, your wire is going to be longer than your arm, so you can walk and talk and do all sorts of stuff. So I would say that DSLR is great if you want to do lots of video, bits and pieces. But for vlogging, use your phone and a cheap microphone that's wired in to give you good sound. Job done.
Agreed. Andrew.
John.
Do you know what time it is?
Time for a cup of tea, maybe?
No, it's not time for a cup of tea at all. It's time for one of the most exciting features we have on this Budcast.
Oh, yes.
Budcast? It's time for one of the most exciting features we have on this Buzzcast.
Ooh.
Do you know what that feature is?
No idea.
This feature's so good, it's got its own jingle. It's Photovator.
So my thought for a great Photovator this month, because the time is right for this, get yourself out into those autumnal woods and start scrambling around down on the ground looking for some fungi, because it's the time they start coming up and you can get some amazing shots of fungi. But you need a few different bits of kit to help the job. So the first thing I'm going to suggest is some kind of ground sheet, because fungi tend to grow lower to the ground here.
Apart from bracket fungus, which may be halfway up a tree.
Well, true, in which case maybe a rope or a ladder would be good. But we're going to assume it's low-growing fungi here. You need to be, it is lying flat to the ground in the old kind of wildlife-y type style, literally almost facing the ground sometimes for this. So it's autumn, it's likely to be damp and a bit horrible down there. So either you've got full waterproofs on that you don't mind getting filthy, or you put a ground sheet down. I actually bought one of those things that you can lay on to inspect cars from a car show a few years ago. So it's actually got a nice bit of foam on it. So if I'm not going to be having to walk too far, I'll take that with me.
But other than that, just the cheapest solution, just a bin liner would probably protect you enough.
Cheapskate.
or some kind of ground sheet. Or you can get a tarp. You can go to a DIY store and get yourself, you know, an 8-foot tarp. That will give you plenty of room. A bit crinkly, so you can't shoot video with that one. There'll be too much sound. But a tarp, a ground sheet, or one of those tent footprint type ground sheets that protect the base of a tent. They're really good as well, but a bit pricey.
Yeah, because you're going to spend quite a lot of time down on that ground. So get yourself comfortable and dry in that way. So the next thing, light. fungi don't necessarily always grow where it's best for getting a good bit of sunlight coming onto them. So you may well need to supplement it. Now, you can see, there's an old article where I've been photographing some fungi using off-camera flash and reflector. That is one good option where I'm softening it with a reflector, so I'm not directly making it look too harsh, the light going on. They're trying to mimic natural light in many ways. But actually, I think the better option these days is probably to use a little LED light panel or even a torch.
Because with those continuous light sources, you can see what you're getting right through the viewfinder and make adjustments accordingly. Whereas with flash, sometimes people get a bit nervous about flash because you set it up, then you fire it, and it's only after you've done it you find out. But when you're looking at what you're doing, that can be a real advantage for photographers.
Yeah, you can really start to model that light. I mean, there's nothing wrong with actually using a couple of them. They're not even that expensive, are they, these little LED panels that you get now?
No, I mean, a lot of it's down to sort of, how accurate the colours are, and that's often referred to as the CRI. That's the index of how precise and accurate the light is for creating the right colours from the subject. But on the whole, you could go to Wilkinson's or some other sort of DIY shop and you can buy battery-powered LED lamps for something like, $4.99 or even less than that. And they'll have the batteries in them as well.
You really are a cheapskate, John. Well, bin liners, $4.99.
I'm a big believer in doing cheapskate stuff, because one of the things, if you do things on the cheapskate way, you discover that you're doing exactly the same as other people who are doing it the expensive way. So if you go out and buy sort of purpose-built, dedicated, colour-controlled LED lighting, you'll find that the results you get aren't particularly any different from what you do with your $4.99 lamp from Wilko's. So, you pay your money, you take your choices, but the end result is what's important. And often that has no difference between really expensive branded stuff and unbranded sort of crappy items you can get from any DIY shop.
And that explains to me your wardrobe.
I didn't buy my wardrobe from B&Q.
No, the things in your wardrobe.
Oh, the things in it. Oh, yeah, I got all those. That's why I like to wear an apron.
Anyway, okay, so bin liner, LED light for modelling the light around the fungi. And you can really, you can create some. Often a bit of backlighting is really good to bring out the edges. Or you might need to throw some light back underneath. I'd still use the reflector to push some light back onto some of those areas where you've got some interesting texture, or sometimes particularly underside of fungi can be quite beautiful, actually.
And on reflectors, if I can offer another cheapskate tip.
Feel free.
Just get some Bako foil, just some tin foil. Crunch it up so it breaks up the dispersion of light. Crunch it up, then flatten it out, and you can mold it to any shape you like. A little bit sharp because it's silver, of course, but, take just some white paper with you as well, because that can work really well as a soft reflector.
Can get a bit soggy sometimes. That's the only thing. Yes, if you've got, particularly in winter, autumn, kind of those damp days if it's a little bit drizzly, which is great actually for photographing fungi, because actually in those circumstances, if you're putting the light in, I actually prefer an overcast day, and a light bit of drizzle isn't an issue. Bako foil's fine, but the paper's not.
Yeah, well, take two sheets then.
You've got to keep the other one dry somewhere. We're not going to argue over sheets of blinking paper. Let's move on. Right, the next thing, just a couple of other things that I think are worth having with you, and that is an artist brush and a pair of tweezers.
Ah, okay.
Because what you can do with that is to remove any little blemishes that are kind of looking a bit ugly that you might think later on when you put it into the computer, I'm going to have to clone it out. Yes, John, I know you'd probably clone it out rather than remove it with tweezers. But actually, I think doing it at the time shows a really good observational eye on what could be affecting the image. And also, sometimes it's just, it's like, why spend that time on the computer if you don't have to?
Yeah, I'd agree, actually. I think that observational...
John agrees with me.
I know it's rare, but yes, cleaning up in Photoshop is fine, but if you don't have to do it, that's even finer.
Yeah, I mean, not always going to be shooting fungi with your macro lens, actually. A lot of the time, you might even be a wide shot to get in environment. Yeah. It could be, a telephoto. But sometimes you are going to be using macro. You get this beautiful little tiny fungi that often grow out of moss, which looks great.
Yes.
With a macro lens. But and I think with macro lenses, those little blemishes look even worse, actually. So that's when I just say I try to pick them out with tweezers, or if you've got a little bit straight stray grass that's cutting into your frame you don't want, you can pluck that out as well, just like, you know, like you pluck your eyebrows, John. It's exactly the same process. Or equally, if you can't get it, something like with tweezers, then yeah, the brush is purely just for brushing off a bit of leaf debris. The trouble is every time it rains, you know, the rain's hitting the ground, and then the detritus on the forest floor is bouncing back up onto
onto the stems.
Yeah, yeah, and the stems are often white, so that, you know, so you've got a beautiful kind of light coloured stem, and then you've got this kind of horrible bit of black oak leaf or something stuck to it. It just doesn't look nice.
Well, there's some comprehensive tips on fungi shooting and the additional accessories you need to make it work. And I think that sums up our Photovator. And it also sums up this particular episode 9 of our Buzzcast. Hope you've enjoyed it. If you have any comments or tips to make or any contributions to make about the topics we've talked about, please put them in the comments below.
That's what this is all about. You feeding back to us. Hope you've all enjoyed it, Photo Buzzers. Until next time, it's goodbye from me.
And it's goodbye from him. Did you like that?
No.
It's kind of a two Ronnies thing.
Yeah, I got it.
Four candles.